It's not an option. It's a right. Cocked, locked, and ready to rock the world of the anti-gunners. You are listening to the guy who had to register his mouth as a full auto weapon. Bill Carnes and 2A Radio. The fight for your rights isn't for pansies. So buckle up for the ride and knuckle down with Bill Carnes and 2A Radio.
Well, hello, everyone. Hello. Today is going to be Dispel the Myths Day, at least for the first half of the show. Here's one big myth. This is perpetrated by an email that's been going out all across the internet to everybody in the States. And it has something to do with you're going to need to register your guns on your tax forms for this year. Absolutely. Completely, totally, and utterly false. Back in the 1980s, some jack wagon member of the House put together a bill that would have required national registration of all of your guns. It never even left committee. But yet, this same bunch of garbage has been going around for the last 15 years, just this year, in the last probably, 18 months or so, it's really been going all over the place. It's not going to happen. It's not what is happening. It is fear-mongering. It's a bunch of garbage. It's people that are worried. There's much ado about nothing. Listen, folks, there's a lot of different places to do research. If you think that something comes across and it sounds like garbage, please do some research just before you hit forward to all in your address book. This is one of those things. Listen to the sound of my voice. This is not a national gun registration that's going through on your 2010 tax forms. It is not happening. Nothing like that has ever even left committee, and it was many years ago that it was even written. National gun registration is not happening. All right? So you understand, we don't need to worry about this anymore. It's a bunch of malarkey. Now, I understand people see this sort of thing. They forward it on. Oh, my gosh, I got to forward it. By the way, if I could give a little bit of advice on how to forward emails. When you click the forward button, you get the original body of the message, and you can change things in that original body. Delete all of the forwarded information that was on there when you got it. My father, love him to death, can't forward an email to save his life. Because everybody else that's forwarded emails to him, I still get all of that. So all of the people that forwarded it to him didn't know how to forward an email either. A good friend of mine, Brian. I've known Brian since sixth grade or something, I think. There are four or five or six of us that met in sixth grade. We're all still buddies. Brian can't forward a message to save his life either. He sends these things off, and there's nine forward lists below that. Don't do that. Erase all that garbage. Anyhow, you don't have to worry about that one. The next one we're going to talk about in the upcoming segment is going to be about the International Arms Treaty that everybody's so worried about. We're going to get to the bottom of this in the next segment. So stay tuned. I'm your host, Bill Carnes. You're tuned in right here to 2A Radio.
You're listening to 2A Radio with Bill Carnes.
All right, now that we have dispelled the myth about the international gun registration. I'm sorry, the national gun registration. Now we want to dispel the myth about the international gun treaty that is supported by the current regime, and of course, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has been involved in. Everybody's really concerned about this. They believe this is going to be some sort of a treaty which will take away the guns out of the hands of the American public. That's not the case. First of all, let's talk a little bit about how treaties work. Treaties can only work between different national governments, as they call them states. Not a state as we understand it. However, each state in this union is, by design, supposed to be its own little independent country, and we are a group of United States. We're kind of our own little UN of sorts. It's the way it's supposed to be. The way it was designed to be. Not the way it actually is now. Every individual country that signs on to a treaty, it is only deals between the countries that sign on to it. And it only, in this case, it only has to do with the import and export of small arms. The most a treaty can affect is business. In this case, the most it could affect is if we end up importing guns from other countries, we might not be able to import all those guns from other countries. Meaning then that American manufacturers could start manufacturing those sorts of guns here in this country. The other thing it could affect is not being able to export guns out of this country to other countries for general purpose sales. Not a lot of that happens anyhow. We import a lot more guns than we export when it comes to private party sales. We export a whole lot of military hardware. So we're talking about a small arms related treaty first. Now, the next point. The current administration can sit there and negotiate this treaty all they want on behalf of the United States wanting to be a part of this. After this whole thing is negotiated, what happens is it needs to go to the United Nations for a vote. If they vote, say, okay, we're going to accept this. Okay, great. There's a bunch of pomp and circumstances, television cameras, dignitaries signing stuff, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't mean squat. Each country that signs on to the treaty needs to go back to that country and go through whatever process each individual country has in an effort to ratify it, so then they become part of the treaty. Let me explain how that works here in the U.S. The president has it and sends it to the United States Senate. The House of Representatives has nothing to do with it. The Senate needs to look at this thing, bring it up for a vote, and it needs to be passed by a two-thirds majority. That's 67 members of the Senate. What's called a supermajority. Same thing that they need to do to override a presidential veto. 67 out of 100, two-thirds. All right? It does not go to the states. It goes to the Senate. The reason is, prior to the 17th Amendment to the Constitution, this is the way things worked, the House of Representatives represented the people as they were elected by a popular vote. The Senate represented the states as the senators were appointed by the state legislature. It's the way it should be, but it's not anymore. Since the passage of the 17th Amendment, the senators are now elected by the populace. So now there is no real state representation any longer. Which is the real problem behind this. People, well, I want my senator to represent me. I don't want the state legislature to appoint him. Well, here's the deal. The representatives in the House are supposed to represent you. The Senate is supposed to be represented by the states. So each state has their own way of appointing their senators. That's the way it's supposed to be. That way we have a vote for the populace, we have a vote for the states. That's the way it's supposed to work out. And that's why each state has two senators. So it doesn't have to do with population. That's where the amount of people in any given area gets more representation. That's where the House of Representatives comes in. I digress. With that being said, the Senate would need to ratify a treaty by a vote of two-thirds majority, a supermajority. They don't actually ratify it. They vote to support it. It then goes back to the president, and the president has all of the pieces that he can then ratify. If the president submits a bill and the Senate says okay, and by the time the Senate gets around to saying okay, there's a different president in office, that president can decide to not ratify the bill and basically shred it and say, we're not going to do this. There's different, an inner American CIFTA treaty, I think they call it, which is the Spanish moniker for this inter-American arms treaty that was negotiated by the Clinton administration. It's never come up for a vote in the Senate. Of course, Obama, about 18 months ago, was asking that a vote come up for it. Didn't happen. What we ended up with is we have this treaty that's never been voted on at the Senate level. The Senate could vote on it, could go to the president's desk, and the president could look at it and say, I have no interest in participating in this treaty. And the president himself would not ratify it. So, understand a lot of people say the Senate ratifies treaties. No, the Senate authorizes the treaty to be ratified by the president. Now, in this particular UN anti-gun international treaty that's being thrown about, here is a portion of the actual treaty. It says in here, acknowledging also the right of the states, meaning countries, to regulate internal transfers of arms and national ownership, including through national constitutional protections on private ownership, exclusively within their territory. What does that mean? That means that this international treaty would have absolutely no effect whatsoever on you or I. First of all, any treaty, before it can even be introduced to the Senate of the United States for their consideration, it must first follow all existing national laws, follow all existing foreign policy as set forth by the administration. It must also be constitutional. The Senate Foreign Affairs Committee is generally the committee that gets the treaty to look at before it makes any recommendations, changes, or whatever, and then submits it to the Speaker of the Senate, the President of the Senate. Sorry, not the President, the Majority Leader, pardon me. And once a Majority Leader looks at it, then they can schedule it for a full vote. Oftentimes, they never leave the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee. But that's the first step. Their job is to ensure that the treaty is legal, within the laws of the states, within the laws of the nation, within the constitutional provisions, not that they really worry about that much anyhow with the Constitution. It generally gets flushed by the Democrats, oftentimes by Republicans as well. Then they need to make sure that it's within current foreign policy and it will stand the test of time. Before they even hand it over to the Senate Majority Leader for them to consider whether or not the rest of the Senate should vote on it. So with all of this said, the guns I own, the guns you own, the guns I'll be buying, the guns you'll be buying, are unaffected by this treaty. The only thing that could possibly affect it is guns that are imported into this country for our personal use, sporting arms, defensive arms, things such as that. We might see some things no longer available. Now, that's a maybe. This thing wouldn't go through until 2012 anyhow. It wouldn't come up for a vote in the Senate until after 2012. Even if it did come in 2012, the last time that Congress voted on an anti-gun measure in an election year, they all lost their shorts. That was with the Clinton-era gun ban, and every single one of those jack wagons in both houses that voted for it, for the most part, lost their shorts. And that is when the Republicans took back over both houses of Congress right after that vote. They've learned from their mistakes. They won't do it again. Don't expect this to ever get ratified. Even if it is, it won't affect you and I like a lot of people are being scared to think. Stay tuned. There's more to come after the break. I'm your host, Bill Carnes. You're tuned in live right here to 2A Radio. RoninTactical.com has certified concealed carry training specialists that travel to you and your group of self-protection advocates. Organize a group of friends, family, or co-workers who take their responsibility of self-protection seriously, and RoninTactical.com will send out a certified training specialist who will provide a course of instruction that will get you and your group certified to carry concealed in over 30 states while providing you, the organizer, a commission for organizing the event. Do you travel for work, family, or vacation and want to remain armed and safe when traveling? Contact RoninTactical.com for details on staying home and having one of our certified professionals travel to you to provide the training and credentials for you and your group to safely and legally carry concealed in over 30 states. Call 888-416-4809 or go online to RoninTactical.com.
Tell everyone in the room to pipe down. 2A Radio with Bill Carnes is back.
Everybody, welcome back from the break. Calling to chime in on this topic is Chris in Tennessee on line one. Chris, welcome to 2A Radio.
Good morning, Bill. Bill, I felt sorry for you a while back when your cat got a hold of your trigger finger. That actually happened to me. What I wanted to speak to you about, Bill, also thank you for bringing the story of the innocent guy being shot at Walmart, the way he was assassinated. I thought that was very interesting.
Costco. Let's clear that up. It's Costco, yeah.
Yeah, that was... Bill, what I want to ask you this morning, how are you dealing with your back injury?
My back injury?
Yes, I believe you had a wreck in your SUV and you had a back injury a while back.
No, that was Dave Champion and he's doing okay. Just fine. Yeah, no, my back is Jim Dandy, man, just
okay.
Jim Dandy.
Yeah, the other thing is this concealed weapons permit program that you're not trying to sell, but you have available. What does that involve?
Are you talking about the RoninTactical.com? Or are you talking about...
The 32 state open carry.
Very good question. Now, that is not me. That's RoninTactical.com. They are friends of the show. I've had Justin from Ronin Tactical in. Kim from Ronin Tactical actually owns a company. What they do is they have a group of certified instructors that travel to you in other states all across the country. And they get you hooked up with concealed weapons permits, which will allow you to carry in over 30 states. And they provide this in the form of Utah concealed weapons permit, Florida concealed weapons permit. Oftentimes, depending on the state that you're in, they might be able to teach that state's concealed weapon permit if they have it. Even if you have no CCW permit in your state, or you're in a state that otherwise it's difficult to get, it's a mother may I system, and they don't give them out, like, say, Hawaii, for the most part, or... let's say that you live in Illinois or in Wisconsin where they don't have CCW permits anyhow, but you want to be able to carry when you leave those states, you can call Ronin Tactical and or go to RoninTactical.com. They'll send somebody out with if you put together a group, and they can get you hooked up with the various different concealed weapons permits that are out there. And the neat thing is that a couple of these permits that will get you many states, there's no shooting qualification. You don't actually need to pick up a gun and go to a range. However, if you want to go out to the range and do some actual training, these are high-end instructors. These are high-end defensive tactics instructors. So that's what Ronin Tactical does.
Yeah, well, that's the issue that I have. I've got a concealed carry permit here in Tennessee, and when I've been stopped by the police, I know what the laws say. The laws say you never should surrender your weapon, but I went ahead and surrendered it just to go ahead and make everything peaceful because the police officer wanted to have control of the of the scene because he didn't know me, even though my tags on the car said, you know, veteran, I'll be discharged. But, yeah, that was something that I wanted to speak to you about. Thank you very much, sir, and you have a good Thanksgiving.
You got it. Thanks. Take care. Bye-bye. All right, guys, we're going to now go on with an email that I got actually during the break. And it's during the last break. It says, please address the fact that many illegal laws have been passed unopposed by executive order, one of which is the diplomatic immunity of Interpol. Suspension of the Constitution will allow anything. All right, here's the deal. First of all, laws don't get passed if there's an executive order. It's an executive order. There is no legislature involved. When it comes to things such as diplomatic immunity, that is up to the president and the president's administration to allow for, provided that the individual, group, or organization which is being provided with diplomatic immunity abides by certain provisions. So if Interpol would go beyond those provisions, they would no longer have diplomatic immunity. And also, suspension of the Constitution. Guys, here's another thing that a lot of people are really concerned about. What if they suspend the Constitution? Who is they? Let me explain this to you very, very simply. If anyone were to stand up and try to say something along the lines of, we are suspending the Constitution because of blah, 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 or without any explanation whatsoever, they have just created two different scenarios. First of all, a complete act of tyranny. Okay? A complete act of tyranny is punishable by the people's uprising and taking that person into custody or killing them. All constitutionally protected. You cannot suspend the Constitution. There is no legal provision for suspending the Constitution. Any attempt at suspending the Constitution would be illegal. You can't do it. The courts can't do it. The government, nobody in the government can do it. The president can't do it. The Senate can't do it. Nobody can do that. The reason is the Constitution itself, if you actually read it, the Constitution created the government. The government didn't create the Constitution. The Constitution created the government and provided for those powers. And you cannot allow in any legal, I guess, abortion of this entire scheme that anyone in the government could ever suspend the Constitution because the Constitution provides them with their powers. So you can't have a guppy trying to eat a whale is essentially the way we're looking at it, politically speaking. So there is no worrying about somebody trying to suspend the Constitution. If they do, you kill them. That's the way it works out. Stay tuned, guys. More to come after the break. I'm your host, Bill Carnes. You're tuned in right here to 2A Radio.
You're listening to a guy who packs a gun to shoot the bad guys and packs a mic to shoot his mouth off. Bill Carnes and 2A Radio are back.
Welcome back from the break, everyone. Now we're going to switch gears and we're going to talk about something that is of interest to many people throughout the country. And that is the potential eligibility or lack thereof of Obama to hold office as a natural-born citizen required by the Constitution. That is now being conferred over by the United States Supreme Court. Here's the issue. Some people believe that Obama was born outside of the country and this missing long-form Hawaiian birth certificate, It just doesn't exist, so he was born in Kenya. Well, the real legal argument has nothing to do with that. It doesn't matter if Obama was born in Hawaii, the central of the country, right in the middle of Kansas, or in the Capitol Building Rotunda in Washington, D.C. itself. Obama was born to an 18-year-old mother and a father who was from Kenya in 1961. At the time, Kenya was ruled by British rule. It was a British colony. His father was a British subject. In 1948, a law passed by British Parliament stated anyone born to a British subject is also a British subject. They have national allegiance at birth to the British crown. So, Kenya did not become its own nation until 2 years after Obama's birth in 1963. So even if Obama was born right in the center of the country, right dead center in the country, his father was a British subject, therefore Obama was a British subject. His mother was too young to offer her U.S. citizenship to Obama, considering she'd lived out of the country for a while and come back. Even if she was, even if she could confer her citizenship, at very best, he was born in the United States as a dual citizen. Half to the U.S., half to the British crown. So that means that natural born doesn't work. All the rest of the arguments, whether he's born in the States or not, is out the window. We just have to deal with the actual laws. Even if his mother could confer him citizenship, his father conferred at least half of his citizenship to the British crown. That's not natural born. So, let me read this article to you. It says, is this the case that will break the presidential eligibility question wide open? The Supreme Court conferred today, this actually yesterday, on whether argument should be heard on the merits of Kirchner versus Obama, a case challenging whether President Barack Obama is qualified to serve as president because he may not be a, quote, natural-born citizen, as required by Article 2, Section 1, Clause 5 of the U.S. Constitution. Unlike other eligibility cases that have reached the Supreme Court, Kirchner versus Obama focuses on the Vettel theory, which argues that the writers of the Constitution believe the term natural-born citizen to mean a person born in the United States to parents who were both American citizens. This case is unprecedented, said Mario Apuzzo, the attorney bringing the suit. I believe we are presented with an ironclad case. We've shown standing. We've shown the importance of the issue for the Supreme Court. There's nothing standing in the way to grant us a writ of certiorari, whatever that word is, I'm sorry. Let's see. The Supreme Court decides to grant the writ of certiorari, whatever. It may be a federal trial court in New Jersey to hear the merits of the case, or it may choose to hear the merits itself. The court's decision on the writ could be answered as early as Wednesday, being today. If any court hears the merits of the case, Apuzzo thinks it will mark the death knell of the Obama legitimacy. Quote, given my research of what a natural-born citizen is, he cannot be a natural-born citizen. So it's a death knell to his legitimacy. What happens on a practical level, how our political institutions would work that out, is something else, Apuzzo told WorldNet Daily. Apuzzo observed it is, quote, undisputed fact that Obama's father was a British subject, which is quite true. Never even applied for U.S. citizenship, as far as we can tell. A hearing on the merits is also a death knell because it would also allow discovery. So we will be able to ask him for his birth certificate, and we don't know what that would show, according to Apuzzo. He says, we might not even get to the question of defining natural-born citizen. If he was not born in the U.S., he'd be undocumented because he's never been naturalized. We don't even know what his citizenship status is. Hawaii has said that they have his records, but that's hearsay. We have not seen the root documents. Could you imagine if it comes out that he wasn't born in the U.S.? We would have an undocumented alien. We'd have an illegal alien as sitting as president. Could you imagine? How comical would that be? What a sad, sad comedy that would be. Another attorney who has brought Obama eligibility cases to the Supreme Court by the name of Philip Berg agrees that discovery would sink Obama's presidency. He says, if one court had guts enough to deal with this and allow discovery, Obama would be out of office, Burke told WND. We would ask for a lift of Obama's ban on all of his documents. The last official report said Obama has spent $1.6 million in legal fees, keeping his papers secret, and the total is probably over $2 million now. You don't spend that kind of money unless there's something to hide. And I believe the reason is he's hiding this is because he was not born in the United States. The Supreme Court has never decided to hear the merits of an eligibility case, he added. If the Supreme Court would decide to hear a case, Obama would be out of office instantly. If Congress decided to hear a case, Obama would be out of office. They're taking a different approach, arguing that both parents must be citizens. Apuzzo is arguing the Vattel theory, which asserts that the term natural-born citizen, as used in the Constitution, was defined by French writer Emer de Vattel. Vattel, who worked, quote, the law of nations, that's what he wrote, was widely known and respected by the founding fathers, used the term to mean an individual born of two citizens of the same nation. According to Apuzzo, Congress and the courts have addressed the question of who can be an American citizen, for example, regarding former slaves, Asian immigrants, and American Indians. However, the term natural-born citizen has never been altered. Quote, the court and Congress have never changed the definition, said Apuzzo. The founding fathers understood that the commander-in-chief of the armed forces needed to have two American citizens as parents so that American values would be imparted to him. Apuzzo said the Supreme Court had clearly accepted Vattel's definition of natural-born citizen in dicta, or statements made in opinions on cases addressing other matters. He cited Supreme Court Chief Justice John Marshall's opinion in the 1814 case Venus, in which Marshall endorsed Vattel's definition. Apuzzo also cited the writings of Founding Father David Ramsey, an influential South Carolina physician and historian who used similar language to Vattel. Previous cases challenging Obama's eligibility have all been rejected on technical grounds. Numerous courts have decided that the plaintiffs do not have standing to bring a suit against Obama because they have failed to prove they are directly injured by his occupation of the Oval Office. To me, that's false, says Berg. The 10th Amendment refers to we the people. If the people can't challenge the president's constitutionality, that would be ridiculous. Here's a quote by Apuzzo. He says, my clients have a right to protection from an illegitimately sitting president. Every decision that he makes affects the life, property, and welfare of my clients. Apuzzo said the founding fathers had good reason to require the president to be a natural-born citizen. Quote, they were making sure the president had the values of being reared from a child in the American system and thereby would preserve everybody's life, liberty, and the property in the process. They made that decision, so my clients have every right to expect the president to be a natural-born citizen. It goes to all your basic rights, every right that is inalienable. The president has to be a natural-born citizen. Now, here's the interesting thing. If he is not a natural-born citizen, would this mean that every single piece of legislation that he has signed, every executive order that he's put forth, is now null and void? If he's sitting as president illegally or de facto, as it were, de facto President Obama, that would essentially mean every single thing he's done, every single appointment that he has made, every single thing that he has signed, every single piece of legislation that's gone through with his signature, every executive order, every appointment to the United States Supreme Court, all of that would essentially be up for being undone because he took the office and held the office without constitutional ability, without constitutional authority, unqualified. Well, unqualified as an individual, we've already established that, but unqualified constitutionally now. Let's say this. Imagine if it were found that he was not born in the United States. He were born in Kenya when Kenya was still part of the British colonies. Therefore, he'd be in this country illegally. What do we do then? He would be deported, most likely, to Great Britain. Could you imagine that? You're no longer president of the United States. As a matter of fact, you're in this country illegally. You are now deported to Great Britain, of which you have that's the only citizenship you hold. Could you imagine how unbelievably awesome that would be for us? How ridiculous we would look? But I gotta tell you, sometimes, in order to learn how to fight and be good at it, you gotta get punched and hit a few times. Anybody who has ever studied any sort of fighting, be it boxing, martial arts, whatever, they practice hitting, punching, kicking, whatever it is, but they generally don't practice getting hit. And all of the plans go out the window once you soak up a couple of punches if you haven't trained for it. You got to learn how to get your bell rung a little bit, or at least dinged some, and carry on for a fight to win. For you to be able to win that fight, pardon me. This means, if all of this comes down and Obama's booted out of office, what's going to happen then is every single time that someone wants to run for president of the United States from this point on, the people are going to insist, and the House of Representatives are probably going to make themselves a longstanding rule, that they must go through some sort of investigation by the House before they can be allowed on a presidential ballot. Keep in mind, they did that in the last presidential election, but with John McCain, not with Barack Obama, with John McCain. Why? Because John McCain was born in Panama. He wasn't born in the United States. He was born in Panama. However, he was born on a United States military base to an American mother and an American father. His father was stationed at the base. I believe he was the base commander, if memory serves correct. So he was born on a U.S. facility, what was U.S. property, hence U.S. soil. Even though it was in Panama, U.S. citizens were the parents, U.S. soil was the place, although it was not within the borders of the continental United States. For that matter, Obama was not born within the continental United States. If he was born in Hawaii, as he claims, he was born on an outlying area outside of the continental United States, still within a state. But now the question's going to come up, if discovery is allowed, can they actually provide an authentic, not forged, an authentic birth certificate that is in the long form? A Hawaiian long form birth certificate of Obama's birth has never been produced. Never. All we've seen is the short form, and that thing has been debunked by many different experts as being a fake. Now, my background, growing up, I grew up in a print shop. My family owned a very big print shop. I know what it takes to create a document. I know what it takes to create false documents. We've seen all kinds of garbage come through. We know what securities are put into a lot of documents. We used to print computer-generated checks, you know, those PIN-fed checks with the Mickler encoder and all of the different fancy things that you've got to have on a check for securities. We know all of that stuff. So to look at an authentic, say, a ticket stub or certificate or some sort of official form, and then to look at another one that's trying to be passed off as that, with a background like mine, you can tell whether or not it's authentic or fake. There are certain things to look for in the reproduction process, not the reproductive process, the reproduction process, how somebody did it. We used to actually get paid to do things like make fake fight tickets for heavyweight bouts, because the hotel casino property would give us a ticket, say, please make this make a fake one and show us what the difference is so our security can tell the difference. Stay tuned, guys. There's more to come after the break. I'm your host, Bill Carnes. You're tuned in right here to 2A Radio.
If you live in a state which allows Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories, and you either have an interest in or already own Class 3 NFA items, the process for an individual to own these items includes photographs, fingerprints, obtaining a letter of permission from your police chief or sheriff, and a full personal background check which is spread across the whole federal system. Until now. Forming an NFA trust eliminates the requirements of letters of permission and all personal data and background checks in purchasing and possessing NFA firearms and accessories. NFA trusts offer a level of anonymity as well as flexibility in the purchasing, possessing, and storage of your Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories. To learn more about forming a secure and flexible NFA trust at a fraction of the cost from attorneys, visit www.billcarnes.com and click on the NFA tab. That's BILLCARNS.com and click on the NFA tab.
As long as politicians attack our rights, Bill will be fighting for them. 2A Radio with Bill Carnes is back.
Back on!
Hey guys, welcome back from the break. Gonna switch gears here now. We're gonna talk about New Jersey. Now there's some New Jersey politicians who are now demanding a list of gun owners and NRA members, and that has passed committee. Their invasive personal privacy legislation has passed the committee. This is on Monday, November 15th. The New Jersey State Government Wagering and Tourism Committee approved by a vote of 3-1. It's a committee of four, obviously. Introduced by State Senator Barbara Bruno, Democrat, and Loretta Weinberg, another Democrat. This legislation would require organizations such as the NRA and the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs to send information regarding their contributions to the government. Specifically, S-2379, the name of the bill, would mandate that any, quote, issue advocacy organization, end quote, classified under IRS code as a 501c3, 501c4, or 527, that engages in the election or defeat of any person to state or local elective office, the passage or defeat of any public question, or that provides political information on any candidate, submit the names and addresses of contributors and their employers to the Election Law Enforcement Commission. Now, a contributor would be someone who pays a membership due. You get that? At this time, S-2379 hasn't yet been scheduled for debate on the Senate floor. However, those of you in New Jersey need to keep checking this out. You can go to NRAILA.org for any developments. Certainly get a hold of your senators and try to get this thing squashed. That's really what you need to do. Can you imagine that? Any organization whatsoever that is a 501c3, 501c4, 527, that participates in any election-related matters whatsoever, would have to disclose all of their members. Now, I don't know if it's just the members within that state or if it's all of their members nationally to the New Jersey Election Law Enforcement Commission. Kiss my backside. That's what I'm talking about. Pucker up and kiss it. Now, if you think you can get away with this legally, well, evidently, you don't understand the way that the Constitution is written. You probably haven't even read your own state constitution, and therefore, You're not qualified to sit as senators. Guys, thanks very much for tuning in. Have a fantastic Thanksgiving Day tomorrow. My best to you and yours.
I'd like to close by saying, to those of you within our government, we will be watching you in Congress, the executive, and judicial branches all very closely as we organize to save our freedom, liberty, and country. We will not become the subjects of governmental rule.
Thanks for tuning in. Bill will be back tomorrow. Now go side in and shoot straight. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes. Learn more about Bill at BillCarnes.com. Send your comments to Bill at 2aradio.com.